This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today, coming to you today from Washington, D.C., home of the NL East leading Washington Nationals. That's right, 1-0 after beating the Mets on opening day yesterday. And of course, baseball is back, and that means that winter is over, and we're all starting to feel better about the weather, maybe. Well, this hour, we're going to explore some of the impacts, not of the weather, but of climate change, with a look at who has the most to profit from global warming. Also, the political hurdles standing in the way of effective climate change policy here in Washington. Plus, a municipal election today in Iron County, Wisconsin, could determine the fate of plans to build the world's largest open-pit iron mine. We'll hear why environmentalists are concerned about the impact of the mine on the state's waterways and how and why the Koch brothers are getting involved in a municipal election. But first, GM, just a few years ago, the resurgent survivor from the Great Recession. Remember that? Well, now GM is recalling yet another 1.3 million vehicles because of problems with the electronic power steering. Now, that brings the total number of cars recalled by GM to 6.1 million since February, and the total recall-related costs for the first quarter could total up to $750 million. Now, all this comes as GM's new CEO, Mary Barra, testifies today and tomorrow in Congress. For more on the recall and the fallout for General Motors, we're joined now by David Cole, Chairman Emeritus at the Center for Automotive Research. Hi, David.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Good to have you. David, what is going on at GM? Recalls are not uncommon, but this is looking endemic at the company. What's happening over there?
Well, to begin with, once this began with the ignition system, and as they took a deep dive throughout the company on anything that could be a potential problem, they said, we've got to get it all out there. But people should understand that when you do a recall, there may be only a very teeny fraction of the vehicles that have a problem. Well, in fact, what triggered this with the ignition system is something we've seen over the years, and that is you can have very serious problems, but to get to the data that tells the story is extremely difficult. And, of course, most people are really not aware of the complexity in a car. We try to make it simple so that you can interface with it very well. You don't really see the complexity. And that's one of the challenges, get to the data to tell the story. And what basically GM has said is we want to get every potential story out. We want to get this thing solved. We want to work closely with NHTSA because in this particular case, the initial one with the ignition system, the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, they had a problem, GM had a problem, and normally they work very closely together on these things, and for some reason they didn't get to the story as quickly as they should have.
Except that getting to the data is one thing. As I understand it, one of the issues likely coming up today is that the subcontractor, Delphi, that makes those ignition switches told GM they weren't any good, and GM may have went ahead and used them anyway. That's not a data problem. That's a using faulty parts problem, and not telling anybody.
Yeah, but you have to look at the whole story. And in fact, my wife has assaulted us with one of those, and she has about 5 pounds of things hanging off of the key ring and has had no problem. And it's extremely rare, but it is a potential problem, and so you've got to do something about it. But getting that story to a point where you get action is not as easy as you might think in a very complex organization. It's the same kind of thing we see with healthcare and the Affordable Care Act. It seems easy on the forefront of doing this. The execution when you're dealing with complex systems in complex organizations is very, very difficult. One thing that everybody should be aware of, and this is true of GM and every other automaker in the world, is that the worst thing you can do is try to cover up something. So there's never an attempt to do this. The system somehow didn't work to get all of the data where it could tell the story and you could proceed with doing what you have to do, and that is to fix these vehicles.
All right. Well, David Cole, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and one of the issues there is, like with the website, government competence running a system. And in addition to what happened at GM, there's going to be a lot of people asking about what was going on with regulators in the Obama administration. Now, they missed some of the data. They apparently missed some of the safety problems. What's at stake here for the regulators at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Traffic Highway Safety Administration, and whether or not they missed things?
Well, I think there were errors everywhere. And of course, one of the most important things, and it's not for GM and for NHTSA, it's to make sure the system is robust. You find something. Historically, the auto industry and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration have worked very, very closely together on this. But when you put large organizations together, sometimes things can slip between the cracks. And we've got to get to the bottom of this, make sure the system is far more robust than it is, and we'll move on from there.
So not an issue that we hear about sometimes of, you know, an administration telling their regulators to back off a company that's friendly or a company they want to do well because they were bailed out after the recession,
no.
You know, to a lot of news reports, nothing like that.
No, if that were the case, that is a serious problem. I think you will find that that is not the case. And whether you're in government or in the auto business, if you know something and try to hide it, that is a cardinal sin. In fact, anytime somebody down in an organization attempts to hide something that is important, that's immediate firing when it's found out. There's just no questions. The cover-up is the worst thing you can do. And what we want to see here out of this, basically, whether it's thinking of GM and NHTSA or the rest of the industry, is to make sure the system is robust and strong as possible to identify these problems quickly and get the solution out to the consumer just as quickly as possible.
David, before we let you go, what's at stake here for Mary Barra? She's newly installed as the CEO at GM, a high profile, I believe testifying for the first time as leader of that organization. What's at stake for her?
Absolutely. Well, she's an exceptionally talented woman. She started out in manufacturing. She has risen through the organization and had tremendous responsibility. Very solid person, but this is the first time on a really public stage. And it's a very interesting and challenging spot for her. But I think what people will find out is that she is extremely concerned about this. She's very competent. I think she'll prove to be an exceptional leader over the years at General Motors.
Well, a big test to be sure today for Mary Barra, GM CEO, testifying in Congress. Also a test for GM itself after being bailed out in 2009 by the taxpayers, and for federal regulators who are going to bear some of the responsibility today in testimony before Congress. 6.1 million recalls at GM since February. David Cole, Chairman Emeritus of the Center for Automotive Research. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Todd.
Meanwhile, a big report from a United Nations panel outlines some major concerns for the state of the planet. Sea levels are rising, ice caps are melting, water supplies are under heavy stress, coral reefs are dying, and we're facing intensifying weather patterns with heavy rain and heat waves. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the UN, global warming is real, it's affecting every continent, and time is short. But despite this report and dozens of other calls for action in Washington, and you've heard them, it seems there's simply no political will to change business as usual or make headway on combating global warming, at least not in Congress. Well, joining us now on the line is Carol Browner. Carol Browner served as director of the White House Office of Energy and Climate Change Policy from 2009 until 2011. And before that, she served as head of the EPA under President Bill Clinton, currently senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Ms. Browner, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. Well, a sobering report from the IPCC, and a lot of people saw it. I know that you read it. But let's go back to Congress. Look, we all know that there is going to be no climate change legislation in this Congress. We already know how divided everybody is. But what's the genesis of the opposition? And it's not just Republicans. You've criticized Republicans, of course, in the past. They're not interested in this, but there are a lot of Democrats, too, who don't want to vote for cap and trade or climate change legislation. What's going on?
Well, I think there are two things going on. I think, first of all, you're right to note how important this report is. I mean, it is telling us that this is yet again, it is real. The scientists all agree it's real, and we've got to get on with doing something. But what's going on in Congress is really two things, money and quite frankly, the news cycle. It is the amount of time that members of Congress have to spend raising money, the amount of money they have to spend, leaves a little time. And then I think for a lot of the news media, you know, they cover a story very, very briefly. They don't have the time and or the willingness to do what you all do, which is to go in depth and really look at the issues. And so folks aren't really getting the kind of news, and they're not understanding the magnitude of the problem that we face.
Well, hang on. I mean, all of that is true, and those are truisms in Congress, but they do still tackle tough problems. I mean, right now, the atmosphere in Congress is a war on coal, so-called, from the White House, calls to increase drilling for natural gas and oil, but no calls really in Congress to go the opposite way on carbon. So what's going on with the politics of this? Who's behind all of these attitudes on both sides of the aisle?
Well, you're right. There's a lot of chatter in Congress, but in terms of actually passing important pieces of legislation, that's not happening when it comes to the environment. The kind of bipartisan support that public health environmental protections enjoyed, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I was at the EPA, simply doesn't exist today. Now, I think the good news is that the president is using his existing authority, the laws on the books, putting in place, proposing shortly standards for coal-fired power plants, for natural gas-fired power plants, requiring them to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. He's already required cars to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to become more efficient. So it's not as if nothing is happening, but we do need Congress to engage. We absolutely need Congress. And right now, you know, the House day in and day out seems to pass anti-environmental measures. They don't seem to have any interest. You do have some in the Senate. You had, I think, more than a dozen senators take to the floor in a evening session all through the night talking about climate change, trying to raise the issue to get their colleagues to engage. But, you know, I go back to where I started. Unfortunately, right now, the amount of money involved in running for Congress, the amount of money that outsiders, people who are opposed to strong environmental protections, are putting into races is really sort of driving the day, unfortunately.
Now, Carol Browner, you headed the Office of Energy and Climate Change Policy at the White House, and that office was closed after only 2 years under President Obama, closed in 2011 after your tenure. You know, a lot of people in Washington saw that as a White House bow to the forces in Congress who didn't want that office operating, didn't want you operating. Why did that office close? What happened?
The president and I agreed from the very beginning that I would work with him for 2 years to sort of get a program up and running. We were able to reach an agreement on cars, the toughest fuel efficiency standards ever, more than 54 miles per gallon by model year 2025, trucks, the first greenhouse gas standards. And now you have, you know, the agencies. You have Gina McCarthy at EPA using her authority under the Clean Air Act to propose and set standards on power plants. The president last summer laid out the climate action plan. So it's not as if nothing's going on, but it's very common in administrations that at the beginning you organize things and you get things up and established, and then the day-to-day workings of the agencies take hold, as well they should, because that's where the power is ultimately vested to set the enforceable standards. And that's what's important here.
Also, a lot of forces in Congress, of course, Carol Browner, who were against that office to begin with. Let's remind people of Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, who ran for Senate by taking out a gun and shooting the climate change cap and trade bill attached to a tree on television. Carol Browner, former director of the EPA and former director of the White House Office for Climate Change and Energy Policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier today, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry finished up an unannounced visit to Israel. During the trip, he met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, the reason for this visit, there's an urgent push to keep fledgling peace talks going between Palestinians and Israelis. And it turns out there's someone who might be able to really help as a potential bargaining chip in this entire process. It's emerged that the Obama administration is considering freeing American Jonathan Pollard, who was convicted a long, long time ago of spying for Israel. It's something that the Israelis have been pushing for a lot of years. They want him released. Mark Landler is White House correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and he's been following the story. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Todd.
Well, we got to go back to the 80s. Remind us about who Jonathan Pollard is and what he did.
Jonathan Pollard was a naval intelligence analyst who in the mid-1980s, over a period of about a year and a half, handed over a great deal of classified data to his Israeli handlers. It was primarily information about U.S. intelligence on Arab neighbors of Israel. He was caught in late 1987 and sentenced to, actually late 1985, and was sentenced to life in prison. And he has been in North Carolina for close to three decades now, serving his sentence. But his cause has become very celebrated in Israel, where he's not viewed as a spy or a traitor, but as someone who, you know, spied on behalf of a country that he also had loyalty for. And so successive Israeli governments have asked the United States to release him.
And he's since been granted Israeli citizenship, I think, in the mid-90s, and his parole is coming up. So even though he's kind of a cause célèbre in Israel, is his release enough to jumpstart stalling peace talks?
Well, it's a very good question, and we don't know the answer yet. Presumably, the U.S. would be seeking more than simply extending the talks. And in fact, the latest reporting suggests that Secretary of State Kerry is looking for some sort of a broader deal where the Israelis would agree to extend the talks through 2015, that they would release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, and they would agree on some sort of a partial freeze on Jewish settlement construction in the West Bank. So there would be several elements to an agreement here that would be predicated on the release of Jonathan Pollard and presumably would give them a much longer window to try to get a comprehensive peace deal done.
Okay, now that's all the upside in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, such as it is. The downside, of course, back here at home, is that the U.S. intelligence community hates nothing more than a traitor. Think about their reaction to Edward Snowden. And Jonathan Pollard, to them, is a traitor. What happens at the White House if they alienate the intelligence community, if this guy's let go?
Well, it's a very difficult decision for President Obama and previous American presidents, even those who've come fairly close to releasing Jonathan Pollard or have thought about it seriously, Bill Clinton being the most obvious example, have decided in the end not to. In the case of Bill Clinton, in 1998, he was faced with a very similar set of circumstances. It was the same Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was making the same argument to Clinton, which is, if you give me Pollard, I'll agree to a deal with the Palestinians. And President Clinton faced the prospect of his own CIA chief, George Tenet, resigning in protest over this. And in the end, Clinton decided he couldn't take that step. So the question the White House, I think, is calculating is it's now another 14, 15 years later. This gentleman's parole comes up in, as you pointed out earlier, in November 2015. If you're going to play this card, you don't have a lot more time to play it. Perhaps with this amount of time passed and the prisoner having served close to 30 years in jail, perhaps the reaction in the intelligence community will be less fierce this time.
That's a big perhaps. At the same time, the CIA is currently at war with the Senate Intelligence Committee, or at least big parts of it. Is it a good time for the White House to pick a fight with the rest of the intelligence community over a guy who could just stay in jail?
Well, it's a valid question, and you can probably analyze it both ways. On the one hand, you might assume that the director of the CIA, John Brennan, has other problems, other fish to fry, and may not want to turn this into a major dispute. On the other hand, he's already, as you pointed out, in a deeply antagonistic position vis-a-vis the Senate. And so a move like this that could further poison the atmosphere might be the last thing that the intelligence community or the Congress want, for that matter.
Bargaining chips and pawns in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Jonathan Pollard, longtime prisoner, U.S. spy, is in the balance. Mark Landler, White House correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, later in the hour, we're talking about finding poetry in everyday life, thanks to our friends down at WLRN in Miami, who've started a poetry contest using the phrase, "This is where." And we want you to participate. All you have to do is write a short poem describing a place that's important to you and include the hashtag ThisIsWhere, all one word. Now, if you're in South Florida, be sure to tweet it at WLRN, and 5 winners will have their poems published on WLRN and in the Miami Herald at the end of the month. If you live elsewhere, listening to us somewhere else outside Miami, tweet it to us at The Takeaway. We've gotten some great poems already. Maureen, via our Facebook page, writes, "This is where I long to be for a bit of chat and a cup of tea, where the land is green and its people warm. Despite cold and wind, there's resounding charm. Ireland."
Carmen Martell, Brooklyn, New York. "In dreams, I hover far above the north light, mingling with soft summer stars. This is where I can stand up with 360 degrees of bay and ocean, one with infinity. Block Island."
"This is where they shot him, one man acting on the malice of many. This is where he slept and talked with friends. And there is where they shot him, two hands firing the rifle aimed by a multitude through a lens of bitter hatred. This is where I have brought my child, a generation later, so the shot would never really kill the man." The Lorraine Motel, Memphis, Tennessee.
Tell us your "This Is Where" poem at 8778MyTake, or tweet it to both at WLRN and at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com.
We are officially in the Elite Eight of our TV SmackDown competition, and in the process of determining our final four in our bracket contest, the best TV characters of all time. It was yesterday, Mary Richards of The Mary Tyler Moore Show won with a slim margin over Liz Lemon of 30 Rock.
Ah, blurg!
And our Cinderella contender, Data of Star Trek Next Generation, demolished Tony Soprano of The Sopranos with a whopping 59% of the votes. Star Trek Nation, you are being heard, although I've heard that there's quite a lot of campaigning going on behind the scenes for Data. And the games continue today and get a bit more nasty with Lucy Ricardo of I Love Lucy, of course, and the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey now entering the arena.
I love Lucy and she loves me.
You can't be serious. The Countess?
I cannot find the words to say how I feel.
You want to put Lucy of I Love Lucy, a character that created the sitcom, that transformed women's comedy, up against a lovely old bird with a bit part on an English series retread of Upstairs Downstairs, who isn't even the best actress on the show?
In the old days, their mothers used to train them, at least in the basics. Now they arrive knowing nothing.
That doesn't seem fair. It's like telling American Homer Simpson to move over for that other Brit, Tracy Ullman.
Go home!
No. Lucy made TV, created a whole genre. The Countess, at best, gets a few laughs.
Lucy, you haven't got any breakfast.
It's on the stove. Get it yourself.
Now, Lucy.
Listen, I am no longer the doting housewife. If you are going to send me out into the world of business to earn my own money, you can just treat me like a fellow businessman.
Lucy proved she didn't need Ricky, her co-star, on her first series. Then she proved it again on 4 more series and a variety show or two. Take the Countess out of the Abbey, and what do you got? Downton Acres, the denture years? Leave her at Hogwarts. Go Lucy, because as I said, Lucy rules. Another layup, folks, on the way to the Final Four.
Lucy as the First Lady of Television? Of the 20th century, perhaps. But consider the words of another First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, who said, "People grow through experience if they meet life honestly and courageously. This is how character is built." And by this test alone, Lucy cannot match Lady Grantham. Only the Dowager Countess has the confidence and the depth of personality to call it as we all see it.
One can't go to pieces at the death of every foreigner. We'd all be in a state of collapse whenever we opened a newspaper.
And in this ultimate battle between a true blue blood and a redhead, perhaps we should pass over the fact that Lucy was a registered communist. I know, just another pinko liberal show business type. So as you cast your vote for the greatest TV character of all time, remember there is nothing like a dame. Cast your vote at thetakeaway.org.
Well, here's a matchup. That's John Hockenberry defending Lucy Ricardo, who's up against the Dowager Countess, being defended there by Takeaway executive producer, that's right, the boss, Rupert Allman. Later this hour, Agent Dale Cooper of Twin Peaks goes head-to-head with Archie Bunker from All in the Family, so listen for that. But remember, it's up to you to vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to cast your vote. And if you're one of the people out there, and I know there's a lot of you because I'm reading the website, who are still mad that your favorite characters didn't make our brackets, we're opening up the competition. And on Friday, when we have the top two finalists from our brackets ready to go, we're going to add a wild card, a third contestant, based on your comments. So go to the website, let us know which character you think we absolutely have to have on the list, the ones we forgot. Again, you can find the whole competition at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. Think of a place that carries a lot of meaning for you. Picture that place in your head. Can you put that picture into words?
Jane Byron calling from Morristown, New Jersey. Camden, this is where I bought my first house, had my first child, and heard my first gunshots. Walt Whitman's dream of a city invincible died long before, but just as completely as my dreams of helping a city's rebirth.
This month, our friends at WLRN in Miami are teaming up with O Miami, a poetry festival to get members of their community to share poems about the South Florida places they care about with the hashtag ThisIsWhere. Scott Cunningham, co-founder of O Miami, joins me to talk about the new project. Hi, Scott.
How you doing, Todd?
Great, thanks. Also with us, Alicia Zuckerman, editorial director at WLRN. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Todd.
So, Alicia, how did you guys come up with this idea?
At WLRN, we're always trying, I always say that, you know, what we're trying to do with our storytelling is evoke the experience of life in this part of the country. So it's very much about place. And we had to make sure that the submissions that came in said something about that, about the experience of life here in South Florida. And that phrase just seemed like it would mandate that. So This Is Where makes people think about the idea of place.
Scott, you've got an example of your own, a This Is Where poem. Can we hear it?
Absolutely. So I wrote a quick one yesterday about the place where I met my fiance. So this is the poem. This is where I saw her, in the white crushed seashell ash of the parking lot behind Sweat Records, surrounded by the dull complaint of an unheralded punk band, though it's true there are no heralded punk bands. She was wearing sunglasses because this is Miami and it hurts to look and to be looked into. From somewhere beneath the bright ocean of her face, she said my name, a form of this is, and everything that was not her, the squat concrete houses, the silos of beer, the circling helicopter, became this is not.
Scott, I hope if I ever get a fiance myself, I can mention her in the same thought as unheralded punk bands. I love it. That's great.
You.
Well, Alicia, what are you hoping to learn about the place that you live as people contact you there in the Miami area at WLRN with their own poems? What does it do for you about the place where you live?
Well, we cover so much here, not just Miami. We cover from the Palm Beaches all the way down to Key West and out into the Everglades. So there's so much to learn. There's so much sort of like, I think for those of us who live day to day going to work and coming back, there's a lot of the region that we don't experience. And so, again, poetry, I think, is about storytelling. And what we do here at the station is about storytelling. And I hope that we can learn the stories of the people who are all around us.
At the same time, Alicia, I imagine that you get a pretty wide breadth of experience in these poems. I mean, Scott's is an homage to his fiance, and it's very romantic. I have to imagine you've gotten some that are tragic, some that are not fun to read, some that make you maybe feel not great about the city you live in sometimes.
Yeah, you know, there was one that came in recently that said, I mean, it's sort of comical, but it's also sort of frustrating. It said, this is where... every taillight is broken and every turning signal is broken, even on BMWs and Mercedes. You know, this sort of frustration. There's a lot of frustration about car culture here, and there's such a big car culture. I mean, I think we kind of almost rival Los Angeles in terms of car culture, and there's a lot of frustration surrounding that. So that always comes out in the poems whenever we run these contests. But also, there's so much beautiful imagery because it's just such a physically beautiful place.
That's Alicia Zuckerman, editorial director at WLRN, joined by Scott Cunningham, co-founder of O Miami. So here's how you can participate. Write a short poem describing a place that's important to you and include the hashtag ThisIsWhere, all one word, like I said. If you're in South Florida, be sure to tweet it at WLRN. If you live somewhere else, tweet it to us at The Takeaway. And here's a great example. Sandy from Point Beach in New Jersey. This is where I learned to look before I leaped. Faces in my life forever to keep, growing up, growing down. The ocean waves took this town, swallowed up, spit. 8778 My Take is the number if you want to read yours out loud. And there's much more, of course, at thetakeaway.org.
Where are you now? Where are you now? Do you ever think of me in the quiet, in the crowd?
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, we spent some time today talking about the global and the national consequences of global warming, and now we want to talk about some of the local consequences of environmental change. It's a story that's playing out in Wisconsin, a state with a long tradition of protecting the national landscape. But those values are being put to the test now. There's a bill that was approved allowing for the construction of a massive open-pit iron mine in the footprint of the waters of the Bad River, which runs right into Lake Superior. This proposed mine won the support of Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker and the backing of outside conservative groups like Americans for Prosperity, backed by the Koch brothers. With local elections underway in Iron County today, the environmental fate of the region is in uncharted territory. Joining us now to explain, Mike Simonson, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, thanks for reaching out to Western Lake Superior.
It's great to talk to you. Now, this story I know is a big deal in your area. The national scale of the national interest, groups like Americans for Prosperity taking an interest in a local election, was first reported nationally on MSNBC the other day. And I wonder what locals in Iron County finally think about seeing outside money in a local election, a county councilman, something that's never happened before.
They're fairly offended by it. They think that it's an intrusion, regardless if they're for or against the mine. They're a very independent type of people who are not used to the light being shined on as they have been. So today's election may actually backfire for Americans for Prosperity.
Now, this certainly isn't the first time mining projects come up in Iron County, after all, Iron County, or any other place in Wisconsin. Why is this debate different? Why has this taken on such heated proportions up there in northern Wisconsin?
This proposed mine would be the largest in North America. It would be an open pit mine instead of a below ground mine, which is what the history of Iron County is, and as well as neighboring Ashland County. Most of this mine would be in Ashland County, some of it in Iron County, but it's on a very pristine hillside, which has something like 130 streams, creeks, rivers, wetlands, all would be affected, and it all runs down into Lake Superior. So this has such a broad impact and potential impact if it does pollute Lake Superior.
Now, we've said that the Koch-backed group Americans for Prosperity, which is very active in any debate having to do with the environment and global warming, has paid for mailers and been in on this race. Has that invited also the participation of outside environmental groups on the other side?
Right. But they've been there all along. In fact, this is something that's been watched by national and international environmental reporters for the past couple of years because of the legislation that you mentioned, sponsored by the Republicans, pushed by Governor Scott Walker 2 years ago. It failed 2 years ago. It passed last year. Dramatically reduces the amount of regulation on a mine. So this is something that has been watched closely, I think, by a lot of groups, environmental as well as business groups, for a couple of years.
Well, Mike Simonson, of course, we're talking about the potential environmental impact of this giant open pit iron mine. But of course, jobs has to be a huge part of the debate. Let's take a listen to a couple of cuts, some sound from back in January 2012, the debate that went on in the state capitol, in the assembly of Wisconsin. Listen.
I don't know how Democrats with a straight face can sit here and say, you're for job creation, we're not, and you're going to vote against this bill today?
Mr. Speaker, I'll commit to you today, if there are jobs from this bill, Mr. Speaker, a year from now, I will sit in this seat and eat my shoe.
Well, there's some of the rhetoric from the floor of the Wisconsin Assembly. You heard Republican Assembly Speaker Jeff Fitzgerald first, and then Racine Democrat Corey Mason. Mike, that's a pretty good encapsulation, I guess, of the debate over jobs. But do we have any good data, any good prediction on what this means for working people?
Well, as far as the mine itself goes, we're getting numbers, but the numbers are from Gigabic Taconite, which is the company that wants to build the mine. They're saying 600 mining jobs directly, and then a spinoff that would be about 2,000. A lot of the detractors say that call that into question because of a lot of automation going in with mining. But you have to know that this mining area, which is in far northern Wisconsin near Lake Superior, is a really depressed area. Double-digit unemployment is commonplace. It's a difficult situation for a lot of these people to say no to something as big as this.
Now, Wisconsin, of course, not long ago was famous for the debate over union regulations, union laws in that state, or anti-union laws. Are these jobs United Mine Worker jobs? What does the union have to say?
Well, the union's for this. So are a lot of the union manufacturers of mining equipment in the Milwaukee area and such. The Democrats really aren't against this mine. They are against the way that the regulations have been, they say, gutted. Republicans say streamlined. So it makes the process for permitting a mine faster so the jobs come sooner. But the Democrats say, look, when you do this, you're going to compromise the streams. This is a really pretty area, very pristine, and it is in the Pinocchio Hills, which runs directly into Lake Superior, right through the Bad River Reservation. And the Bad River folks, they need jobs too, but they're totally against it. They say this would be cultural genocide if their area was polluted.
Now, let's hear from Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Chippewa Tribe. Listen.
We recognize some of the things in here as being unbelievable threats to us and what we stand and live for. And ultimately, we're willing to go to the mat.
Mike Wiggins, chairman of the Bad River Chippewa Tribe, Mike Simonson, going to the mat, as you said.
Yeah, he was reelected recently, too. So his message is supported not only by his tribe, but also by the other Ojibwe tribes in northern Wisconsin. There are six of them, and they've formed a federation. I think that federation is going to be heard loud and clear because of treaty rights that they've obtained in the 19th century.
Before we let you go, Mike Simonson, any predictions of how this is going to turn out?
Well, it's going to be ongoing. Whatever happens in today's election isn't going to throw the mine out or support the mine, so it definitely goes in. There's a whole regulatory process. Even beyond the state, the federal regulations haven't changed, and they're much more tight compared to the state regulations.
Mike Simonson, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, talking to us about a proposed open-pit iron mine in Iron County in northern Wisconsin. Mike, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Todd.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the UN, the impacts of climate change are here to stay.
One of the most important findings is that we're not in an era where climate change is some kind of a future hypothetical. We live in a world where impacts of climate changes that have already occurred are widespread and consequential.
That's Dr. Chris Field, IPCC co-chair, talking about their new report that was out this week. As dire as it sounds, though, some companies and a few small countries have actually found ways to benefit from climate change Melting ice caps have brought new shipping lanes in Iceland and Greenland and other places too, while companies like Monsanto have found new profits in drought-resistant crops. Mackenzie Funk is an expert on the potential profit of global warming, and he's found a whole lot of them in his recent book, Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. And he says while rising seas may be bad for the planet, they're particularly good for one country.
And you'd be surprised if you travel to the Netherlands and you talk to people. There's not a lot of gloom. There's a lot of talking about climate change as an opportunity. And for a country that's spent, you know, generations preparing for sea level rise, they've got subsidence. They're already very low. So they've been dealing with the kind of sea level rise forever. And they want to sell that expertise to the world. And they're doing so increasingly. They're engineering companies that will build seawalls and storm surge barriers like that for New York City. There are ones that will build you an entire floating city, not just floating homes, but, you know, floating parks, floating schools, floating streets. And that's that they're beginning to sell these technologies everywhere.
What's going on with fresh water? I mean, we hear so much already that, you know, the next war isn't over oil. It's over Mideast water. And climate change can only make that worse. So who has the most to gain from dwindling fresh water supplies in these tough parts of the world, do you think?
It's actually really hard to make a lot of money off water, and that's for two reasons. One, everyone has heard that story before, so a lot of governments have very protectionist laws about water. You can't just sell it across the border in some cases. You can't do it from Canada, for instance. And it's very heavy. It's about 8 pounds per gallon. So putting that in tankers, like people talk about shipping around the world, it's actually kind of a stupid idea. The people who are making some money off this are small hedge funds that invest in water rights. And you can do that in the American West, and you can do it in Australia, and you can do it in a few other places. You can separate the land title from a water title, and you can trade water like it's a piece of stock up and down the river system. So I visited a hedge fund in California that works on the Colorado River and elsewhere, just buying up water rights. And that gets sold to cities down the stream. It gets sold to whoever wants it.
All right, Mackenzie Funk. I mean, I like to be prudent. I like to save. I want to make some money for my future. Let's say I have, you know, a couple thousand dollars, a little nest egg before we let you go. Where's the smartest money right now if I at least want to, you know, get a little bit of personal profit off of a global catastrophe?
You know, I'm not sure it's in climate change. From what I've seen, a lot of these investment funds that would allow the general public to join in, they've got such a short time horizon compared to how climate change is. I mean, if you're an investor, you want to see returns not on even a 5-year scale. You want to see your money back in 1 year. You know, climate change, as much as it's with us, is still many years out. A lot of these funds do badly by the way we measure things. You've got to have a 30-year view, and I'm afraid I don't think that many of us humans do. That's the problem.
Well, Mackenzie Funk is an expert on the profit of global warming. He has a book called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. The takeaway there might be a lot of money to be made, but not in 1 year, not in 5 years. It's a long view investment. You got to have 30 years to make your money. Mackenzie Funk, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, they're getting ready for the Final Four in the NCAA basketball tournament down in Texas, but we are still in the Elite Eight, that's right, in our TV Brackets tournament competition, where TV characters go head-to-head and others go to die. We're trying to determine the greatest of all time. With you, the listener, today's votes will help determine who makes our Final Four. Entering the arena now is Archie Bunker from All in the Family up against Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks.
People like to say that we're in a golden age of television. All these taboo topics and complex characters like Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks. True, but that golden age started in 1971 when All in the Family introduced us to Archie Bunker.
Oh, no, you ain't applying for no job. A woman's place is still in a home.
Why did the Irish farmer spray booze on his vegetables?
He's a good father, that guy. A real good one.
Very funny, Arch.
Yeah, well, I thought so.
Talk about a complex character. Here was a racist, bigoted xenophobe trying to make sense of a changing world.
This is why every citizen should have a loaded gun in his house, you big mouth liberal, you.
How many times have I told you I don't believe in violence?
As for taboo topics, Archie Bunker talked about everything from homosexuality to the Vietnam War.
You hear this over here, draft dodger? Fugitive from justice, you know, FBI. How'd you like the FBI coming to have dinner with you here?
Oh, Archie, we ain't got enough turkey.
All in the Family paved the way for today's era of television. It turns out old Archie Bunker was ahead of his time.
Barker, what is this world coming to?
Beats me, Jefferson. All I got to say is, here's to yesterday.
There's never been a greater television character than Archie Bunker. Vote for him at thetakeaway.org.
Who doesn't love curiosity and wonder?
Do you know where dreams come from? Acetylcholine neurons fire high-voltage impulses into the forebrain. These impulses become pictures, the pictures become dreams. But no one knows why we choose these particular pictures.
Medical science is a lot of crapola.
You can just picture Dale Cooper's bright smile against Archie Bunker's glower. Archie might call Dale a rube, but Coop has seen some things. Horrible murders, betrayal. He lost the love of his life. And yet he still finds everyday joy.
And two more pieces of this incredible pie.
Grumpy, egotistical Archie might make us feel better about ourselves for a moment, but is that the measuring stick we should hold ourselves to?
Oh, what the hell's the sense of talking to you two anyhow? Just get away from me, leave me alone, all is. I want to watch TV.
We all have our dark thoughts and bad behavior, but what do we want at the end of the day? Compassion counts for a lot.
Laura Palmer's death has affected each and every man, woman, and child because life has meaning here, every life. That's a way of living I thought had vanished from the earth, but it hasn't. It's right here in Twin Peaks.
Every man, Archie Bunker, defended by Takeaway Movie Date co-host Rafer Guzman, up against Takeaway engineer Vince Fairchild defending Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks. But it's up to you to vote. Go to the website at thetakeaway.org to cast your all-important vote. And remember, we're opening up this competition to you. This Friday, when we have our top two finalists chosen from the brackets, we're going to add a wild card, a third contestant, based on your comments. A lot of you think we forgot some of your favorite characters. This is your chance to get them in right at the end of the contest. So go to the website, let us know which character you think absolutely has to be on the list. Again, you can find the whole competition on the website at thetakeaway.org, and it's up to you to vote. Well, let's end the show today with some Frankie Knuckles, the godfather of house music. He was a legend in New York and Chicago and a lot of other places, too. Frankie Knuckles passed away on Monday at the age of 59. If you like anything about house music in the last 30 years, you've probably heard something influenced by Frankie Knuckles. And so we'll head out to some beats from the man. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. He's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing Reputation Scoring for Businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.